Oh, good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.
You have a visitor tonight. Welcome. A little piece of Wednesday night approaches and sits with us. Let's do introductions around.
Judy, Ellie,
Wendy,
Jeffrey,
Samia,
Cynthia,
Marie,
Carolyn.
So nice to see you. We are in the middle of a book about cooking. I don't know if you know this book of Dogen's. Yes, if you cook in the kitchen, you know this very well. Right? Some of you do. And we've come to my favorite chapter just because it's the subject that is so interesting to me. He's calling it On Parental Mind. This is the commentary by Uchiyama Roshi that comes after the actual Dogen thing. I think because there are so many teachings that we inherit in a book like this, or in the sutras, or in the teachings that teachers give us. But then they're the ones that you actually experience, that it's not just a supposition or a suggestion or a picture of what might be, but it's something that happens to people. And that it happened, and then somebody wrote it down. And then you get the writing. And then you read it, having not had that experience, and think, I wonder what that is all about, or maybe I'll get that sometime. It's so interesting to me how that is. And twice I've had an experience like that. The first time, when I was sitting very early in my life in Sesshin, I started thinking about all the different people that I knew, all the people that I really, really liked, and all the ones that I was very upset about, and the ones that I didn't like, and it just went on and on and on. I thought, man, this is really something. And I just started sort of blessing everybody in my mind. And then a couple of years later, somebody introduced me to the Metta Sutra. And I thought, it just came to me. And it must have just come to somebody, and he wrote it down. And how cool is that? And then we all get it. And parental mind is like that, too. I had that experience once of, actually, it was a funny situation. It was on the bleachers in San Francisco, down by the water, on the waterfront. And it was in that era when drums were being beaten and, you know, bum, 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 and people were dancing and many, many people were walking back and forth. And I was just sitting there in a kind of haze of delight, and I suddenly thought, oh, these are all my children. I don't know why I thought such a thing. It seemed very strange now to say so, but I felt it so strongly. Oh, these are my children. And I think that's the feeling that Dogen was talking about. Not that there are kids that we have to diaper them and, you know, teach them manners and worry about them when they don't come home at midnight or any of that stuff, but just that there's some deep family connection among all of us that sometimes we are, I don't know, open enough, you could say, or attuned enough that it becomes an experience that Dogen felt somehow in talking about how to cook food in a way that would be the way that would nourish the monks. He said, with a big mind, with a magnanimous mind, and a parental mind. And though that sounds like a, like we're supposed to go out and be something special, Uchiyama Roshi goes to great lengths to point out that that is not what it means. It means just for each one of us to take our life seriously and do it, and do it as best we can and with a lot of not ardor, he used another word, but ardor is another, a good one, to really enjoy our life as it is. That's parentaling ourselves. And as a result, it becomes part of the whole family of everyone. Are they somewhere?
Do you see them?
No, I don't see them.
On the inside of them.
Oh, here they are. Thank you.
You knew what you were looking for.
You read my mind, Wendy. So he starts out talking about the Satipatthana Sutra and a description of, in which it says not to rely on others is to be unmoved. He said, here is where we find true peace of mind, Uchiyama Roshi says. When Shakyamuni Buddha became fully enlightened, he is reputed to have said, I attained the way simultaneously with the whole world and all sentient beings. Everything, mountains, rivers, trees, grasses, all attained Buddhahood. Everything. And we had Rahatsu sit on Saturday and we talked about this, that it wasn't a one-time experience, it was an all-the-time experience, and all the time for all. Sawaki Roshi, he quotes, live the self that fills the whole universe. He says that Tenzo Kyokun teaches us that the self inclusive of the whole world is nothing other than the very things, people, or situations that we presently encounter and know, and helps us to discover our lives through these things, and in turn pour all our life ardor back into them. So Dogen says, once he has the right ingredients, he must handle them as carefully as if they were his own eyes. It's hard to do this in a hurry, and yet I bet many, many Tenzos have worked with this kind of ardor and tremendous hurry, that once you've given yourself over to the effort, that there's a kind of ease and smoothness that goes along with it. Sometimes you don't even know where the meal came from exactly. It just kind of falls into place out of the need for putting it together. it's so nice that it's talking about food and eating, about cabbages, rice, rocks in the rice, just ordinary and real. So he says, big mind is not a matter of meditating on some vast floating spatial dimension. Rather, it is the practice of entirely devoting your life to each and everything you encounter, no matter what it might be. This is hard. I mean, there are a number of things that we would much rather not pay attention to and much rather ignore if we possibly can. We're very skilled at avoiding pain in every way, and we're programmed to pick and choose the things that will keep us comfortable. This is not saying that we shouldn't try to be comfortable. It's saying that in the Zen way, attention, pay attention. Don't let anything slip away. Otherwise, you live in a dream. If it's hard, it's hard. If it's painful, it's painful. And it won't go away by ignoring it. It just gets buried in our body somewhere, and we carry it with us wherever we go. We all carry our ancient pains, you could say, in our bodies still. And the more we're able to recognize what comes up, the more free we become. Unidentified with those things and more able to identify with the world that we are. It's our own world. Uchiyama Roshi is a little cranky in this chapter. He talks about a professor who wouldn't do any work on Taiji. And when he did do some work, he set up a fire under the camellia and burned the branches. So he thought that professor was missing the point. He says, Zazen as true religion can be hardly be considered the hobby of rich and leisurely people, which I guess he thought that professor was. The professor just wanted to read, kick back and read. The wonderful point of Dogen Zenji's practice of Zazen is that it is religion which must function concretely in one's daily life. He taught through the office of the Tenzo, which he felt to be indispensable in a Buddhist community and which requires physical work, because he felt that Zazen as religion must never be relegated only to those seeking to indulge in some rapturous state of mind. It's very unromantic, really. It's very unromantic practice. A rapturous state of mind just sounds so glorious and wonderful, but this is so much more helpful. This just puts us right here in the middle of our own center, our own place. who we are. He said the expression mind and environment are one means to put all your energy into your work. And that is the meaning of shikan, the shikan of shikantaza. Shikan means just this one place, time, person, place. In a small sense, in a large sense, with a little smile. He talks about how to handle things. When you work with a tool, a utensil, you should put it back when you're finished with it and not just leave it sitting around. When you put a pot down roughly, banging it around on concrete or a tiled sink, it cries out in pain, says Uchiyama Roshi. If you still are unable to hear that cry, then you can hardly be said to be a person living out zazen in your daily life. So that's another instruction in Zen. Listen. Listen. What do you hear? Many cries of pain. Many, many cries of pain. And that's the description of Avalokiteshvara. You're on the cries of the world. And is equipped with whatever each individual is equipped with to do something. In the beautiful statues in Japan, you see Avalokiteshvara with many, many hands, and each one has a different implement. A toothbrush and a hammer and a shovel and a you can imagine saws and brooms and surgical instruments. And each one of us has tools. Each one of us has arms and hands like Avalokiteshvara. And they're all different. And none of us can solve the problems of the world, but we can all respond to the cries of the world. He said, of course, this applies not only to utensils and things, it applies equally to situations and people. A person can hardly be said to have a religious attitude who treats a teacup carefully, almost piously, simply because it is expensive, yet who feels nothing in treating people roughly. We should always strive to treat objects, affairs, and particularly people with good care. When we begin to see that our every encounter constitutes our lives, or to put it another way, as we begin to understand the deeper ramifications of big mind in our lives, this mind or attitude naturally begins to function as the mind of a parent in regard to everything we meet. So he talks about parental mind as being irresponsive, irrespective of poverty or difficult circumstances, loving and raising a child. But not all of us have loved and raised a child, and I think it's a different kind of mind from, it's the kind of dedication and devotion that is the vow that we take to save all sentient beings. It's closer to it's a different kind of sensitivity, I think. There's a lack of ownership in it. I think in having children, we have children, and in a way we are so responsible for them. All through our lives, I've discovered. I thought once it was over, but it's never over. Such a surprise. And of course, there is that element in it too. Of course, especially if you know someone who's sick and you go and tend to them, it's very much like tending a child. In my young years, I used to tend to several old ladies who were not well, and I felt like they were more like my children. But there's a bigger mind in what he's talking about, and I guess it's the magnanimity and the big mind itself that is a part of it. And then he finishes off with a little riff on the Japanese bureaucrats. They're just totally off the wall. They're silly. These public officials. So he does tie it up by saying, devoting the whole of life's ardor to all the circumstances and people we encounter in our lives, in the same way we devote ourselves to our own children, is precisely how we shall find the true meaning of life. Always looking for the meaning of life. It's how we shall find the true meaning of life. Even in loving a child, I do not mean that we should continually pander to its every whim. Living with a parental mind also means to be prudent and aware of the child's real needs, lest we stifle the child with blind love. The Tenzo Kyokun teaches us in detail about the active functioning of this kind of mind or attitude. He has such a straightforward way of talking about things, Uchiyama Roshi. So, are there questions, comments?
Seeing Sylvie here reminds me of the experiences at the kitchen at Tassajara, because...
Did you two work together?
I guess we have, but you know, it's every day, it's new people,
mm-hmm.
And it's you don't really talk except for, you know, functional speech. Not that it's silent, but they just try to keep the talking down. And... you see people who, you know, you're given a task, and you see people who want to, like, get in your business, you know? Like, they want to, they're not assigned to tell you what to do, but they want to tell you how to cut that onion or how to do something like that. So there's people like that, or people who try to talk, or try to start up a conversation or something like that. And I was thinking about just that parental mind of just, kind of being indulgent with them, not indulging in the activity, but just being patient and, you know, not kind of Mm-hmm. You know, if they say something, you know, thank you, or if they try to start a conversation, just, you know, monosyllable so you don't get involved in it. And then there are people that always want to rush in and help, and it really doesn't work really well in that kind of, because there's one person who's in charge, and I think they talked about that in the book, that everybody kind of has their place, and when you try to rush in and do somebody else's job, it kind of interferes with the flow and, you know, what the Tenzo and the assistants are trying to do with it. So it's kind of interesting to see how that all works out in an instant, because mm-hmm. you're all put together and you all have to do. And then there are people who don't like to do, they're given jobs they don't like to do, and you can kind of tell they're, you know, holding their nose or, you know, slack. And it's very interesting little pot, melting pot.
Like the professor who didn't want to rake the leaves.
Yeah. Cleaning the, there's mats in the kitchen that are really gross, and people don't like to clean those. So.
Mm-hmm. The kitchen makes a great metaphor, especially when many people are cooking in it together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're all in the kitchen. We all have a job. Sometimes it's a challenge just knowing what our job is. What is our instrument? What can I give into this situation? That's maybe our biggest challenge, is just to discover and then enact that. And it changes through time. So we're always having to go back and figure it all out again.
But I just thought a little bit more about this, and I think that there's an interesting metaphor when you see that when you're in that situation, because it's happened to me a number of times, because, you know, I like to get things done and accomplish things. And if you kind of rush in there and try to do something, it's sort of like when you're trying to help your child, right? And really, a lot of times the best way to help them is just sort of step back and, like, let them figure it out, or let them cry, or, you know, just let them kind of process it. And I think it's the same sort of thing that you, so I've been in situations in the kitchen where I just said, okay, I want to rush in and do this, but let me step back, look at the situation, and mm-hmm. ask some questions or something like that. So being able to step back and see what the situation needs, I think, is also good parenting.
I think that's a good example. I think that's even true of working with materials. You know, if you're going to cut a cabbage, you can either just dive in and hack it up, or you can step back and become familiar with this particular being and see what it needs and then work together with it. And it works much better that way. And it tastes better too. I swear it does.
I was surprised to hear the word religion when you were reading. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, some people call Zen a religion, mm-hmm. and some people say absolutely not.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So Koban always said that it's not a religion, that Zazen is not a religion. Mm-hmm. Zazen is Zazen. And out of that, you can create any religion. And most religions are based on a Zazen experience itself. So some kind of feeling of wide, deep, powerful connection with everything that is just natural to us as we sit. And it's natural, I think, to create some sort of devotional practice and some kind of, it can get very elaborate. You know, Zen in Japan is enormously elaborate. The temples are full of golden things and dingling, dangling, and, you know, lights and candles, and it's just, it's not what you would think at all. So they created what Uchiyama Roshi considered to be moribund, that it really isn't actually functioning anymore. And it certainly is struggling. There are a few people who are working very hard to keep it alive, but it's really hard. It's natural, I think, for every human enterprise to start out fresh and very simple, and it's really hard to keep it simple. Quakers have done it. That's why it's so good to meet here, I think, because it's so simple still. They haven't gussied it up at all.
There's an awful lot of books back there on the bookshelf about Quaker thought.
You're right.
History.
Yes. But still.
Same thing with them.
There's
a transmission from mind to mind without scriptures. Now, what have we got? Tons and tons of
books. Yes. Yes. All encouraging people to go and meet a teacher and meet mind to mind.
Pay him lots of money.
Well, it doesn't work very well.
I know.
Jeffrey, you had something?
I didn't have anything.
Oh, sorry. Oh, Samia.
Not sure how to ask that question. It will sound like I haven't practiced that at all, but maybe I didn't. Is there a preparation that was done in the history of this practice to help you, or prepare you to sit, like raking, cleaning, or you just roll out of bed, the bell rings, you brush your teeth or whatever, and you just go sit. Like, there are so many different, like, for instance, in gardening, after gardening for so many years, I feel before getting to something done really well, the leaves have to be raked, the poop has to be picked up, so you don't step in it before you go to that. I don't know, in your practice, the years, have you found, like, if you brushed your teeth first and combed your hair and got out of your pajamas, it helps? Or that's all a waste of time? Or washing the dishes, like, sometimes I can't sit if the kitchen is a mess, or is this just an excuse to delay something?
Well, it's only you can know this.
Yeah, but I know I'm older, but I feel so young. Like, sometimes you need somebody to tell you, forget it, just go sit. Or were there things done that helped?
Well, in a monastery, of course, there's a schedule, and mostly it's work.
So there is work.
It's all work.
Before you sit.
You sit early, early in the morning,
uh-huh.
And then if you're the cook, you're out there in the kitchen cooking for everybody, and then everybody has to clean up, and then everybody has jobs to do. If you go to a practice period in San Francisco, you're just working all the time. And then there's a sit at night. So it's just like at home. You sit in the morning, and if you're home, you can sit again at night. And then there's a sesshin. And in a monastery at Sasahara, for instance, there's a session, a week-long sit, once a month. So then you still have a job, just like we know, because we work really hard in our sessions. But there's a whole lot more sitting, much, much more, depending on which job we have. So in every case, it's all about sustaining life and connecting with life. It's not about having to sit like it's medicine that we have to take. It's just our way of coming back home to ourselves so we can do what we do. So if you can sit before you wash the dishes, you know, you could make that a kind of principle. Or you can just let them go. They'll wait. Very patient. Well, it's a little after 8. Are there announcements? Are we all set?
I think there's the sign-up sheet's printed and it's out on the board if anybody wants to check. There are the sign-ups, but I think I've talked to everybody. I don't remember who's next week, but it's on the board.
Also, I wanted to remind everybody Christmas Day, if you don't have anything going on, there's a non-religious shindig at our house where good food and coffee and in the morning and a little alcohol in the afternoon. But you're all welcome. Bring your friends, people you like, people you don't like.
It's always delightful. Also, I have family coming. Ben is coming this week, and then next week for Christmas, Toby is going to come with Teresa. So Carolyn is going to be here for next week's Tuesday night. Thank you very, very much. And then I will see you the following Tuesday. One minute sit.
But you'll be here the 22nd.
I will.
Yeah. Okay.